Okay, welcome everyone. My name is Alberto Toscano from the HMEB to this session on surplus populations, history theory analysis. Unfortunately, we don't have our third speaker, had to cancel at the last minute, Erwin Chung. We have two really interesting papers, and also, you know, maybe worth pointing out that this is actually a theme that we've had a number of panels on at conferences in previous years, and we're, you know, also hoping to, you know, host the discussion over the theme in the journal in various ways around his work, around the kind of debate that Erwin will be talking about later. So we'll have two talks of around 25 minutes or so, and then open it up for questions. So our first speaker is Stuart Eldon, and Stuart's professor of politics at Warwick, and written a whole number of books, most recently I think Birth of Territory, and is just finished, or is just about to publish in April, a book called Foucault's Last Decade on the Genesis of the History of Sexuality Project. And further book on the relationship between the archaeology of knowledge and discipline and punishment in that earlier period. So his paper is entitled Foucault, Portionnet, and the Revolt of the New Pied. And okay. Over to you.
Thank you. Good morning. In the summer of 1971, Foucault wrote to his partner Daniel Defer to say that his new preoccupation with prisons had come as a real escape from the weariness he was feeling in relation to literature. And he added he'd recently begun doing research on the history of juridical practices. The most recently published, the last of Foucault's College de France courses, Penal Theories and Institutions, out in French earlier this year, not yet out in English translation, certainly begins to discuss those themes. It's really where they first appear in Foucault's work in detail. Courses delivered between late November 1971 and early March 1972, the very time that Foucault is doing some of the most radical political activism of his life, working with the Prison Information Group and also groups on health and less directly asylums. This was a time of a number of prison riots in France. Some of you may have seen the recent film Sous les Toits on the prison revolts in France at this time. And in the opening page of the manuscript of his course, Foucault notes that he's going to dispense with an introduction and says that the raison d'etre for the course is simple. People should just open their eyes. The links between what they will see in France at that time and the course's content, he thinks, should be clear. A number of interviews that Foucault conducted around the time that he was delivering this course also give a sense of his political views. They include the discussion with students from Actuel magazine from November 1971, the debate on popular justice with Maoists from February 1972, and the Intellectuals and Power interview with Gilles Deleuze from March 1972. So this 1971-72 course goes a long way, I think, to show the impacts that the militant activism had on his theoretical work and vice versa, although Foucault immediately recognises that the title of the course, Penal Theories and Institutions, is missing a third term, that of practice. The course splits roughly into two parts. One is about the birth of the medieval state and associated practices of inquiry and ordeal, especially in relation to prisons. The second one, that theme, relates very clearly to Foucault's long-standing interest in what he calls the politics of truth. He reuses some of this material in much later lecture courses in Rio and in Levant when he talks about the practice of truth-telling. That analysis on the birth of the medieval state is preceded by a number of lectures on the New Pied, the bare feet revolts of 1639 to 1640 in Normandy, along with their forcible subjugation by the apparatus of the French state, particularly by Cardinal Richelieu and Chancellor Seguier. The New Pied were so called because they were the salt makers of the Avranches region who walked barefoot on the sand, so the barefoot revolt. Now, Foucault is often criticised for talking of the positive, productive side of power, but only ever examining it in relation to antiquity, and he's sometimes criticised for not showing how resistance takes place or is even possible, but I think this course provides something of a corrective to that view. In this detailed analysis that he makes of the New Pied revolt against taxation, and particularly the repression that follows, Foucault makes extensive use of documentary materials, especially an 1842 edition of the Chancellor's Journal. Much of his source material, though, derives from the work of earlier historians, including the French Catholic historian Roland Meusnier's book Führer Paysan, Peasant Uprisings, but most importantly, the Soviet historian Boris Porchnev. Porchnev's Le Soulèvement Populaire, Popular Revolts, in France between 1623 and 1648, had originally been published in Russian in 1948, translated into French in 1963. But the theses in that book had become an object of a French debate because Meusnier, this Catholic historian, had written an article in 1958 that was later republished in a book in 1970 where he criticised the claims that Porchnev had made. Foucault also makes use of one of Meusnier's students, Madeleine Foissil, and her 1970 thesis on this topic. And Foissil, as a student of Meusnier, and it seems to me that many of the other French accounts that have been published in the intervening years have largely tended to follow the lead of Meusnier's work. So it seems to me that there's obviously a French nature to the events that Foucault is talking about, these revolts in 17th century Normandy, but there's also a French nature of the debate that is going on about how you should understand those. And of all of those books I've mentioned, only Meusnier's Peasant Uprisings is actually available in English. So why did Foucault find these events, and to an extent the debate over them, of such interest that he's prepared to devote 7 whole lectures to the study of them? Well, Porchnev's claim is that the revolts are predominantly about taxation and that they are spontaneous peasant-led revolts against a situation that puts them in intolerable poverty. The revolts are not aimed at the king, but at those that benefit from feudal rents, both the nobility and a significant number of the emergent bourgeoisie. Porchnev suggests that feudalism is structured through the extraction of revenue from serfs by landowners, and from the 16th century on, the monarchical state enables the levy, collection and distribution of this rent, and it's one of the mechanisms by which the state becomes increasingly centralised. So the monarchy on these terms is not a break with the feudal system, but increasingly its agent. Capitalism at this time, this is Porchnev's view on it, capitalism at this time is isolated and marginal, and the bourgeois class exists in relation to the dominant feudal structures. The bourgeoisie are embedded in the system but do not play an especially important role in the class struggle at the beginning of the centralised monarchy. But on the contrary, the peasantry do play an active role, and the new PA can be understood as a revolutionary political force. In Foucault's lecture course, Claude Olivier Durand provides an essay that situates Foucault in relation to all of these historical debates, and Durand makes a real stress on how in France at the time, in the 60s and through into the early 1970s, the importance of Maoism, and particularly the gauche proletarienne, and the insistence of a linking that needs to be made between the peasantry and the workers. So he suggests this is one of the reasons why Foucault is so interested in this uprising. In contrast to Porchnev's view, Meusnier suggests that many of the observations that Porchnev makes have a genuine scientific value, and several arguments in support of those theses are strong, but he rejects his work in general terms because he thinks that Porchnev forces the facts and relations into the framework of a Marxist theory, which the topic explodes or disrupts. The key issue between them is class. Meusnier suggests that class only emerges as a central theme in the 18th century, whereas Porchnev sees the new PA as a kind of pre-proletarian class. Porchnev's view is characterised as suggesting that French society of the 17th century was a feudal society characterised by the predominance of feudal economic forms and means of production. Capitalist means of production were only found in isolated instances in some towns. But in those revolts, Porchnev sees an anticipation of the kinds of struggles that would follow. So Meusnier suggests that the theses of Porchnev's work, solidly constructed, contain plenty of partial truths, his words. But the overall picture, he says, cannot be accepted, and he thinks that the idea of a peasant bloc against the lords is no less plausible than a class front against the peasants. He goes on to claim that if the nobility were, as Porchnev thinks, the active guardians of the feudal absolutist order, it must be recognised they played their role very badly. But Meusnier emphasises the fractures within the blocs, stressing differences in tensions, lack of coordination and absence of genuine links. So essentially, Porchnev is providing a class analysis of the period, giving the peasantry a major role, whereas Meusnier thinks that seeing class parallels with later proletarian struggles is anachronistic. But the debate needn't be an either-or. Perry Anderson, for example, uses both Meusnier and Porchnev in his work Passages from Antiquity to Feudalism, and has this to say of Porchnev. Contrary to his intimations of his Western colleagues, it is not a rigid dogmatism that is his major failing, but an over-fertile ingenuity, not always adequately restrained by the discipline of evidence. yet the same trait is in another respect what makes him an original and imaginative historian. And Foucault, it seems to me, also tries to steer a course between the two positions. In Paris, at the Bibliothèque Nationale, Foucault's reading notes have become available to researchers, and there are very detailed traces of the notes that he took on both Portionnev's work and on Meusnier's critique of it. And in general terms, what it suggests is that Foucault is closer to Portionnev politically and to Meusnier historically conceptually. By that I mean that, like Anderson, he's suspicious of the overarching themes that Portionnev develops on the basis of limited and selective evidence, and that class relations are not, certainly for Foucault, the major structuring force. But the emphasis on struggle, power, and broader politics are things that attract him to the topic and to Portionnev's account of it. And I do think it is intriguing, given Foucault's proximity to Maoism at this time, that his choice of focus for this detailed analysis is of a peasant rather than a worker uprising. Now, in the analysis of the new PA, it becomes increasingly clear that Foucault's principal interest is not so much in the revolt itself, but in the reaction of the authorities to it, to the subjugation of the peasants and the emergence of a new repressive state or system. It's actually not a theme that's especially stressed by either Portionnev or Meusnier, despite both of them relying principally on the archives of Chancellor Seguier for their accounts. Foucault thinks that in these events and the subjugation of them, it's important that he can discern the first great deployment of the arms, the force of the state, independent of the person of the king, a characteristic that Foucault describes as armed justice. And it's Chancellor Seguier who's tasked by the king, Louis XIII, with putting down the rebellion in December 1639, and that Seguier arrives in person in the town of Rouen on the 2nd of January 1640. The king's absolute power over the armed forces and the judiciary delegated down to Seguier. And just over a week later, several of the agitators are executed and several more are imprisoned. In February, Seguier moves on to Caen, then to Bayeux and to other locations through March when the uprisings are over. Foucault underlines that this armed justice that he's talking about is not an institution but an operation or a series of operations which cut across and to a certain extent displace existing institutions. Foucault stresses very clearly the clash of competing exercises of power. This is not for him simply power imposed from above. The study of the new PA is for him one of a sequence of refusals of the law and struggles against power. But it's important, I think he stresses, not to set power and law on one side and peasant refusals, struggles and resistance on the other. The king, the state, individuals such as Seguier and the peasants all exercise power. For Foucault, for the new PA, the rejection of the law is at the same time a law. It is like the other side of law, he says. The rejection of justice is like the exercise of justice. The struggle against power is a kind of power. And that emphasis on power relations, which are really beginning to emerge in his work at this time, before this, they're not nearly so explicit in his work. This emphasis allows him, I think, to make use of the documentary work that both Portionnev and Meusnier do, but without being bound by either's overall framework. He takes from Meusnier the emphasis on different groups, clashing competing interests and fragmentation, but he sees these reflected in the overall contours of Portionnev's account that something fundamental is being developed here. So the events in Normandy and the suppression of the revolt, Foucault says, should be understood at the level of manifestations of power. The armed suppression operates first, the legal system comes in much later. And this is a chronological gap that Foucault puts a lot of emphasis on, of an unchecked use of power to assert and protect the king and the nascent state first, and only then later the administration of justice. How does that sending in of the army and the retaking of civil power get manifested? Well, Foucault stresses that we should look at things like ceremonies, rites and gestures, but these should be analysed through an analysis of forces, and that they should not be looked at simply in terms of a semiotics, but rather by what he calls a dynastic of forces. And in the early 1970s, Foucault seems undecided whether the term that is going to sit alongside archaeology is going to be genealogy, which of course is the term that becomes the most important, or what he calls a dynastic analysis. So Foucault's looking at issues of manifestations of power, gestures, ceremonies, and so on, and he talks about how this can be understood as a theatrical representation of power, a development of this, or an unfurling of this in time and space, a visible and ceremonial form of men, signs, and discourse through which the exercise of power takes place, the theatre of power, he calls it. So he's looking at this in terms of this sequence of events that takes place, and particularly interested in this gap between the suppression through the army and then later the system of justice. And he provides quite a detailed chronology of the events in the course. But this chronology or this presentation is clearer in a lecture that he gave in Minnesota in April 1972, so about a month after the course finished. And that was a text that had until recently only been available in an English summary. This was a text entitled Ceremony, Theatre and Power, Ceremony, Theatre and Politics in the 17th Century. And this text, which is just an English language summary of Foucault's lecture, is now translated back in, or translated into French to appear as an appendix of this lecture course. So Foucault presents this as kind of the five acts of a dramatic presentation of the retaking of power by the French state. The first stage, the sending in of the army and the army alone. Power designates the population as an enemy, disqualifies it as a political subject. The army executes people immediately, it tortures them, it tramples on the rights of the population more generally through the billeting of troops. It doesn't recognise the people as a legitimate force within the existing social order or as a foreign power, but thinks of them as an enemy within or an internal enemy. The repressive practice that Foucault identifies here in the mid-17th century is what he goes on to study in other works, as the great internment or the great confinement of people, including groups such as the paupers, the unemployed, the beggars, the vagabonds, the seditious, and so on. It's there in the History of Madness, but it is particularly there in Discipline and Punish, of course. The second act is when the military crackdown has taken place. Local dignitaries and delegations send people to Paris. The Archbishop of Rouen writes to Cardinal Richelieu and to Chancellor Seguier. But also local parliament don't register edicts, they don't reconstitute offices in mild opposition to the rule of Paris. And parliament here are not simply parliaments, they're more kind of like local authorities with local representation, but a range of powers. And Foucault says this links to the traditional French theory, Claude de Cécile is a good example of this, of the checks on the power of the king, religion, justice and the police. And in this instance, though, those things are denied. Seguier largely bypasses such traditional procedures of the exercise of power. He prevents people from going to Paris to appeal, says decisions have already been made, refuses to hear petitions, and so on. And he makes appeal to something that Foucault calls the final judgment, the most formidable and fantastic manifestation of powers that can be understood, because it implies that the king is not himself bound by the laws of the kingdom, but is directly led by God. So it's an example of royal absolutism and the beginning of that for Foucault. A type of power that would sweep aside all checks, all limitations. A power that would make stark divisions of people, would disqualify the rebels as a political subject and see them not as another example of power within civil order, but as simple enemies. The third stage is when civil power reappears, when Chancellor Seguier and local state officials enter Rouen in the beginning of 1640. It's not simply the people themselves, but the bodies that they represent that are important. These were figures that had largely remained backstage while the army went down and did the initial suppression of the revolt. But the army falls now under the control of the Chancellor, who unites Foucault the functions of war and justice. But this isn't a standard use of justice, because Seguier does not consult others in reaching judgments. He hears witnesses but not the accused and passes sentence verbally rather than in written form, all of which were seen by contemporary French jurists as extremely serious breaks with legal protocol. Now Foucault says, of course, this isn't one of the first times that a revolt has been put down violently, but stresses there is something new here because the violence is employed not simply during the struggle but after the struggle has actually been stopped, in terms of the repression that goes on. So he says it's not simply the army and justice, but it's the repression that follows that. The king can dispense justice between individuals who are his subjects, but he provides the defence of his subjects against enemies, but he can and also must repress sedition from his subjects. So Foucault sees the justice, the army, and the repression as the three elements of this. Now, while the actions of the Chancellor are seen as a development of a purely repressive function of the state and linked to the duties of the king, this function is employed without the direct involvement of the king. Seguier is exercising his power directly, even if he has been authorised by the Conseil du Roi. The king becomes increasingly detached from the actual practices. Seguier and those like him represent, or rather constitute, the whole of state power. Foucault says, in the place of the absent king, the visible body of the state appears. So these new people that have got this particular kind of power are embedded in a feudal system of ground rents, the imposition of levies and taxes, the distribution of rents, pensions and roles. So he says a state apparatus exists, which is a fiscal apparatus. And you should stress that the term apparatus here is a translation of the French word appareil. It's not dispositif. Dispositif does not feature in this course. So functionaries and financiers take the place of the king as the repressive state recalibrates justice and the army. The fourth of these five acts concerns the particular actions that Segovia takes in his role, suspending local authorities, appointing temporary commissaries to act in his stead. He doesn't make new institutions, but new people from Paris are appointed to offices, and the reorganisation changes the relation between the crown and these suspended bodies. The local parliament and the mayor shift from being autonomous agents to operatives on behalf of the central authority. Their legitimacy does not come from local sources, but from the king. And in the final scene, as Foucault presents this, of this theatre of power, which is clearer in the Minnesota summary of the lecture than in the Paris manuscript, Foucault gives examples of the military and compensation measures that are put in place. There's disarmament of local forces, selective concentration of military resources, and major revenue redistribution towards the central state, raised by a combination of direct and indirect taxation. The military and financial double guarantee enables the state to pardon the population as a whole for the revolt. The key figures, of course, have already been executed. The rich are pardoned because they're the financial and military guarantors of order. The poor are pardoned because they are the taxpayers and the producers of the fiscal levy. So Foucault closes this analysis by stressing that in time, all of the functions which appeared in the course of these events and which were exercised in temporary measures, in gestures, in ceremonies, etc., all of these functions the state still entrusted to the bourgeoisie, the local nobility, to the parliament, in the feudal form of arrangement. And with the Fronde civil wars of a little later in the 17th century, he says it becomes increasingly clear that they need to be centralised further into a specialised state apparatus. The control of populations, he suggests, becomes too important to be left to uncertain allies and needs to be by an instrument solidly held in the hands of the state. So the visible manifestation of power here is no longer is the state rather than the king. And in those in these lectures, I think we can see Foucault beginning to search for formulations that trace the emergence of a less visible, more autonomous, more anonymous form of power. There are initial examples in this course. This is 1971-72, but it's developed in much more detail in the 1972-73 course, The Punitive Society, which has just appeared in English, where depersonalised systems and relations become his predominant focus, and then takes on a much stronger version in the published book Discipline and Punish in 1975. So the events in that first part of the course of the analysis of the new PA for Foucault, fundamental to the emergence of a new system of the exercise of political power, which becomes in time the idea of penal justice. He suggests that the popular revolts are crucial to the history of the state and economic transformation, but neither in the way that Pourchaeff sees them, nor how Meusnier sees them. Pourchaeff sees them as part of wider trends and resistances in feudalism, with the nobility upholding their existing position, a class analysis that's indebted to Marxism. Foucault, though, stresses a discontinuity. Meusnier sees them as relatively minor events within a wider shift to the emergence of the monarchical state, but Foucault stresses their crucial pivotal role. The new PA revolts are situated by Foucault at the dividing line between the repressive feudal system and the repressive state system. There's actually a diagram in the course where 1639 to 40 is the cusp point in that transition. So the reading of these small and people would sometimes perhaps suggest marginal events says, I think, quite a lot about how Foucault views the emergence of the disciplinary society within the wider conjuncture of the demise of feudalism, the birth of capitalism, and the emergence of the monarchical and then the modern state. But it's read by Foucault through the lens of power relations rather than historical materialism. So that analysis takes the first seven lectures of the course, and then Foucault shifts to the transition from early Germanic law to the emergence of the monarchical state in the medieval period, the high medieval period, we might call it. And that shift in the course, I think, is rather abrupt. What we have for this course is only Foucault's manuscript. There are no extant tape recordings of this course, so they've simply published Foucault's manuscript rather than transcribed what he actually said. But the point is of the shift between the two parts of the course is that Foucault wants to go back and do a genealogy of the institution that form what he sees emerging in 1640, the repressive state apparatus, and he does that as a genealogy of the fiscal, political, and military registers. So if 1639 to 40 marks an emblematic moment of emergence, the lineage of the concepts and practices stretch much further back. Now, what's interesting, I think, is in the course summary. Now, Foucault writes his course summaries usually in June of the year after he's given the course, three or four months after he's finished delivering the course. And he sometimes stresses things that weren't really there in the course and sometimes neglect things that were a large part of the course. And the course summary actually says almost nothing about the work on the new PA. He says largely things about the medieval work on the inquiry and says only a few lines on the popular revolt and mechanisms of social control. He simply says this part of the course was devoted to the emergence in 16th century France, not 17th century France, or slip there, of new forms of social controls, which is a very partial reference to what he's devoted so much of the course itself to studying. And that's one of the reasons why I think this seven lectures on this material is going to be such a surprise for people. There's almost no other anticipation of this work elsewhere in Foucault. It's almost as if, I think, Foucault's used this analysis of the new PA of Richelieu and Segrier entirely instrumentally, despite the extent of the work, and is now moving on. He's used it as a way of opening up a question that he's then going to study in a different way through the rest of his work, through the next course and through Into Discipline and Punish. Indeed, the editors of the course suggest that it's surprising because this is one of the most detailed engagements that Foucault provides with multiple topics, including the encounter with Marxism, with the law, with the Middle Ages, and with popular revolt. Now, the editorial notes that Bernard Harcourt and his colleagues have produced for this course make a great deal of work at use of Foucault's preparatory manuscripts, which I've been beginning to go through in Paris, and I think that these open up some interesting questions. But what I'm interested in, what I've tried to talk to you about today, is the way that Foucault's not just interested in the particular historical events, but also seems to be interested in this historiographical debate between the historians about how they should read these events. Thank you.
Thank you very much.